It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster, in for Rob Ferret on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll get inspiration for garden fresh savory summer pies.
But first, immigration has been pushed to the forefront in recent weeks as President Obama grapples with what to do with the more than 52,000 unaccompanied children that have streamed across the U.S. border from Central American countries since last October.
The president asked Congress for $3.7 billion in emergency funding. He's been under fire from both Republicans and immigration advocates who oppose the president's move to try and offer voluntary removal as an option to the undocumented children.
Fawn Johnson joins us now. She is a National Journal correspondent covering domestic policy issues. She's been covering immigration since the Clinton administration. And Fawn, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
Well, first, the question that we should ask first is, why is this happening now? Why are we seeing this surge of migrant children coming across into U.S. borders?
There's no real good answer to that question, but the best explanation that we have is that there has been a surge in violence in those three countries. This is primarily Honduras, El Salvador, and Guatemala. And for whatever reason, there has been this thought from parents that if they bring or send their children up to the United States, that they will be taken care of here. And to a certain extent, that view is correct. The 52,000 or so children that have come across since October have to go through some extensive screening before they can be formally deported back to their own countries if they don't have a reason to stay here. And the immigration services are massively backlogged. So a lot of the kids who have come since October are still here.
I've seen reports that there are even toddlers who have made this journey. What is it like?
Well, there are a couple different ways to come up through Mexico. They're mainly coming up through Mexico and arriving in the Rio Grande Valley in Texas. They can be coming on roads generally through some sort of coyote that they will pay, or their parents will pay to take them with them. That's a dangerous route to take, and those particular people who would be ferrying these kids need to pay off border police and whatnot in Mexico. Another way that they can come, and this is even more dangerous and difficult to imagine, is there is a railroad that goes from some of the southern parts of the Mexican border all the way up through to the Rio Grande area. And kids who don't have the money, which can cost $3,000 to $7,000 to pay someone, can jump onto that train and ride alongside it or on top of it to come towards the part of the northern border between Mexico and the United States, and then they can sit and camp out there for a little while and have some help coming across the border.
Are there parents coming with them, or is it just primarily children?
There are some people who are coming with families. That's one of the things that I think people don't realize, is that while the numbers of unaccompanied minors that we've seen have surged, there's also a surge of people coming across with their children. Now, if they are apprehended, so you have an entire family unit, or say a mother and a couple of children that are apprehended, then the way they are treated is somewhat different, and the Border Patrol officials can repatriate those people back to their home countries relatively quickly because they have an adult present. The difficulty comes when you have someone who is determined to be a minor that doesn't have a guardian. At that point, then the Border Patrol needs to turn those children over to the Department of Health and Human Services, and the Department of Health and Human Services needs to find someone to act on their behalf.
So currently, what happens to these kids and sometimes their parents once they get here?
Well, if they come without their parents or without a guardian, they wind up in the auspices of the Health and Human Services Department. And part of the problem is that this was an unexpected surge. They do have procedures for dealing with unaccompanied minors generally, but it's about a third bigger than they expected it to be, and it all started happening over the last 6 months or so. But anyway, those kids show up, and they are put into the custody of Health and Human Services. They're in shelters, essentially. And right now, the Health and Human Services Department is setting up emergency shelters on military bases all around. They just don't have enough room for these kids. So they're given medical treatment, they're given education, they're given some, depending on their age, legal, I wouldn't call it representation, but some legal instruction about what their options are. And then HHS looks for someone inside the country to take care of them. It's important to note that of the kids who have come over, almost half of them have been reunited with a parent here in the country through HHS. So some of those kids are here with their parents. It's not clear if those parents are documented, but they are with their families, which I suppose we can be glad about.
I've seen some pictures out there of these kids almost being warehoused in what looked to be pretty bleak conditions.
Yeah.
Is there evidence that their basic needs are being met while they're here?
Everything that I know, and keep in mind I haven't been there, would be that I think that their basic needs are being met. The problem is that they are taken into custody at the Border Patrol, and Border Patrol has never been in a position to house people long-term or to house massive amounts of them long-term. It's supposed to be a really quick turnover period where if it's an adult, they'll be turned over to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, which will put them in some sort of detention facility or come up with another way to deal with them. So the pictures that we are seeing of kids in these detention centers at the border are kids who have just recently come across and are flooding the parts of the Border Patrol that were never intended for them. And the other issue, of course, is that the Border Patrol doesn't have a lot of facilities to care for children. And when you have more children than you expect, you wind up having to put them in one place. And they're doing everything they can to try and get them out and put them into a more appropriate shelter. But I think it's safe to say that some of those kids find themselves in some close quarters for at least a couple of days, maybe, while they're waiting to get to a better shelter.
And it's worth pointing out that Milwaukee is being eyeballed as a possible place to take in maybe 100, 200 of these kids, but the verdict is still out on that. And moving to the political side of this, on Tuesday, President Obama asked Congress for $3.7 billion in emergency funding to help deal with the situation. What kinds of things would that money be used for?
It's going to a number of different places. One of the areas that he is looking for is actually bolstering. There's more than $1 billion that would go to the Health and Human Services Department to provide permanent shelters for these children. The Secretary of the Health and Human Services Department said yesterday that when you have temporary shelters, that's actually more expensive than it is to just have permanent facilities for the kids. So that's one of the things that he is requesting. Another thing that he wants to do is pay for a big increase in the number of immigration judges that are available, because that's part of what's causing the delay for these kids, is that they can't get them in front of an immigration judge quickly enough, which is one of the procedures that has to happen. It would also go to bolster enforcement along the border. So this would be people who would be investigating whether or not these kids are coming across in a trafficking ring, and also trying to just generally police the border in a better fashion.
And getting this money doesn't seem like an easy green light from Congress at this point. What has to happen?
Well, the president needs to convince the members of Congress that that the money will be going to places that they think is appropriate. The biggest complaint from Republicans in Congress is that the money right now looks like it's going to the border to help a bunch of kids who have crossed illegally to stay here. And it doesn't help that, of course, the law requires that's essentially what happens, that they come here and then we as a country take care of them. But they also want to make sure that there's a quicker way to process and get these kids back home. And they want to make sure that the president is sending a very clear message to the Central American countries that they should not be sending their children to this part of the country. It's getting mixed up in a lot of complaints that they have about how the president has handled immigration generally, and that doesn't help. There's a lot of distrust between the president and the Republicans in Congress anyway. So I think that what you're going to see is you're going to see a number of requests to either require the president to deport a certain number of people at a certain amount of time, or to change the law to allow him to bypass some of the things that are currently required for these children. And there are some people who oppose that. So it's starting to get to be a political battle that could drag out until September, because we only have a couple of more weeks in Congress before all the lawmakers recess in August.
Do you see this lighting a fire under politicians for immigration reform?
That is always a possibility, but it's hard to know what will actually move them. The debate about immigration has gotten so twisted and so difficult over the last couple of years that it's difficult to find a way out of it. And there have been a lot of conversations among both Republicans and Democrats who are heavily involved in immigration to break it down and to try and make the individual parts of the issue become their own isolated pieces and move those separately. That has fallen by the wayside mainly because of distrust of the president on Republicans' part. So it's difficult to see how this particular situation can do anything but make it worse. The president is, I think it's incumbent upon him to just point out that this is an emergency situation and these kids need to be taken care of, which he is doing. But then in order to move the immigration debate forward, he's going to have to explain to the country and to the people in Congress how he's going to make sure that it doesn't happen again. And that's hard to do.
Fawn, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
That was Fawn Johnson, National Journal correspondent covering domestic policy issues. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. It's Food Friday, and today we're talking about savory summer pies. Farmers markets are starting to fill up with fresh vegetables, and a summer pie is a great way to put them to good use.
Ian Knauer is back with us. He's the host of the PBS series called The Farm and the author of the cookbook by the same name. Ian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, I am a huge fan of pie and all of its permutations. When I think of savory pie, though, right away my mind goes to a quiche. What kinds of alternatives are there out there for savory pies that aren't quiche?
Well, all sorts of alternatives. Although I have to say, I'm not one to kick a quiche out of bed either. So I love a quiche for breakfast or brunch. But this week, I've been making cherry tomato pie because my cherry tomatoes are ready in the garden, even though the rest of my tomatoes are maybe a week to come. So this is a really fun pie. I take about 2 pounds of cherry tomatoes, and I have them, and I toss them with a little bit of mayonnaise, believe it or not, and a whole bunch of herbs and a little bit of cornstarch. And then I put them in a pre-baked pie shell and put that in the oven for about 45 minutes. And those cherry tomatoes sort of burst, and all their juices are thickened with the cornstarch, and you end up with this really incredible savory cherry tomato pie.
Wow. We're at a point where these vegetables are going to start bursting right off the plants there. Why are pies the perfect solution to putting those vegetables to good use?
Well, it uses up a fair amount of vegetable, too, because, like, zucchini is a great example of one of those vegetables where, you know, once you get one out of your garden, all of a sudden you have a dozen, and you don't know what to do with them. You're just making zucchini bread for the rest of the summer. So zucchini is another one of those vegetables where I really like to put it in pies. And it is also a vegetable that is quite watery, so the way to make sure that it doesn't sog out your pie crust is to slice it super thin. So if you have one of those adjustable blade slicers, like a mandolin, this is the time to use it. So I like to slice it sort of paper thin and then make a thin layer of zucchini. A great pie is a zucchini cheddar pie. So that's one that I actually made last night for dinner.
Oh, well, what's in that one besides the zucchini and the cheddar?
Well, not much, actually. It's zucchini, cheddar, a little bit of Parmesan cheese, and then I like to sprinkle some thinly sliced hot pepper over top, so some chili pepper over top, just for a little bit of heat.
That sounds good, too. Well, can we talk about the crust for a minute? Because summer, I feel like the cooking should be a little easier. I shouldn't have to feel bad about myself, for instance, because I can't make a perfect pie crust. Is there a solution to a no-hassle pie crust here?
I think maybe one of the easiest crusts to make is an oil crust. So these became sort of famous in the 1920s, and the Wesson Oil Company started putting an oil crust on their label so that people would know how to make an oil crust. I actually like to make an oil crust with olive oil just because the flavor of olive oil is so incredible. So the way to do this is to take your flour. You start out with, you know, about a cup of flour, and then you add about a third of a cup of olive oil. You kind of work that in, and what happens is it starts to look like a regular pie crust. It sort of beads up, and the oil becomes kind of lumpy, and so you have these little pea-shaped lumps, which is also what you're looking for when you make a butter crust. And then you want to add a little bit of water and salt. So you end up adding about 2 to 3 tablespoons of water and 1/2 teaspoon of salt, and you end up with a dough that looks just like a regular butter crust. You don't have to let that rest. You don't you don't have to worry about having hot hands because you're not going to melt the butter. The oil is already liquid. And then you just roll it out, or you can even press it into your pie crust or your pie tin and just bake that off. It's a really easy and also delicious crust.
Okay, well, that sounds convincing. And that recipe is up on the Central Time Facebook page, by the way, as is the recipe for that cherry tomato pie you mentioned.
And we, you had shared a couple of other recipes with us, one for rough puff pastry and one for biscuit dough. What do we want to consider when it comes to the taste of the crust as we think about the other ingredients that are going to go inside the pie?
Well, that's a really excellent point. So that olive oil crust is great for the cherry tomatoes because olive oil and cherry tomatoes are a classic combination. I really like that rough puff pastry with the zucchini pie that I mentioned earlier, the zucchini cheddar pie, because you get this super flaky crust and a very tender cooked zucchini filling. So you have some nice contrast there. And then the biscuit crust that you mentioned is also one of my favorite. It is almost cloud-like. You get this really fluffy, biscuity bottom and top crust, and that's good for like a tomato and corn pie, which is another one of my favorite summer savory pies.
So is it kind of like a savory cobbler?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I never thought of it that way, but that's the perfect way to describe it.
All right, well, walk us through that one. What's in it?
So the biscuit crust has butter in it, so you're going to cut the butter in with your pastry cutter, or with your fingers is fine. You can even pulse it in with a food processor. And again, you're looking for those pea-sized lumps of butter here. You want some chunks of butter because that's going to give you really nice flake to your crust. And then you're going to add some milk, and in with your flour, make sure you have some baking powder, which is what gives it some nice fluff there for your biscuit. This is kind of a wet dough, and it makes enough for a top and a bottom crust. And I like to roll it out between wax paper or plastic wrap so that you don't end up with it sticking to the counter, which, because it's a wet dough, tends to happen a little more easily. So to avoid that, just roll it out between some wax paper, transfer it to your pie tin, and then I like to fill it up with layers of sliced beefsteak tomatoes, some fresh corn kernels, and a whole bunch of herbs, and then top it off with even more cheddar cheese. I think you'll see a theme here. Cheddar cheese is something that I really like to bake into savory pies. And then that top crust, you roll it up in the same way between wax paper and put it right on top. Put some steam vents in there, and then throw that in the oven, about 400 degrees. And it doesn't take long, about 30 minutes. What happens is the biscuit dough sucks up all those tomato juices and gets nice and brown on top. And the tomatoes and corn, they're not super cooked. You just sort of cook the raw out of them. And they end up being this really refreshing treat. I love this pie when it's hot out of the oven, but I also love it cold, even for breakfast the next day.
Wow, that sounds fantastic to me. And I love the cheese in there. You know, it's Wisconsin. But Cynthia was wondering about the mayonnaise. Can you make the case for what the mayonnaise does in that pie?
Yeah, so this recipe is actually based on an old James Beard recipe and was updated by a food writer in the 70s called Lori Colwin. She did some really awesome stuff. She was a contributing writer for Gourmet magazine. And she put the mayonnaise in there. And what happens with the mayonnaise is it sort of melts and becomes part of the sauce in there. It mixes with those tomato juices and the corn juices. You don't really notice it once it's cooked, but it sort of laces everything together. It does this magic trick inside the pie.
Are you convinced, Cynthia?
I'll give it a try. We'll see. You had also shared a recipe for eggplant lamb pie. Eggplant seems to be one of those vegetables that people either love or hate, but how do you use it here?
So the eggplant in this recipe is really an important ingredient. It cooks down and becomes the thickener in the pie. So this filling doesn't have any cornstarch or tapioca or flour in it. But the eggplant, of course, you know, eggplant gets so silky when it's cooked, and that's what happens here. So the eggplant breaks down, and it sort of binds together the tomatoes and the ground lamb, and there's some really nice warm spices in there, too. You don't actually know, it doesn't taste like an eggplant pie, but the eggplant is what holds everything together in this pie.
Ian, this has got to be heading into the super busy time in your garden, and I know you do a lot of gardening on your family farm. Are you hitting that period where you're starting to get frantic and it's coming up fast and furious?
Yes, absolutely. As I mentioned last week, I walked through the zucchini patch and I thought to myself, oh no, it's starting. So I'm already giving the stuff away.
Well, feel free to give some away here in Wisconsin. I'm sure it would make the travel just fine.
So, Ian, thank you so much for joining us today for Food Friday. It was great to talk with you.
Oh, so great to talk with you both.
Ian Knauer is the host of the PBS series called The Farm, and he's got a cookbook out by the same name.
I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Do you wake up on Sunday morning itching to open up the newspaper and dig into the crossword puzzle? You're not alone.
Over the past century, crossword puzzles have been enjoyed by millions of people, including dignitaries like Queen Elizabeth and even fictional characters like Christopher Robin.
What's so appealing about these brain teasers? Alan Connor is a comedy writer and a quizmaster who chronicles the rich and storied history of crossword puzzles in his new book, The Crossword Century, 100 Years of Witty Wordplay, Ingenious Puzzles, and Linguistic Mischief. Alan, welcome to Central Time.
Hello, thank you so much for having me.
Well, the crossword puzzle turned 100 last year. Take us back to the beginning. How was it born?
It was born in a bit of a panic, if the truth be told. There was the newspaper, the New York World, had a section called called Fun, which was their section full of puzzles. And the chap who populated these pages with puzzles was called Arthur Wynn, who'd wanted actually to be a kind of Pulitzer-winning journalist, but such was his fate, he ended up in charge of the puzzles. And one Christmas, he was told there was going to be twice as much fun as normal. And he only knew so many puzzles and had to fill up his pages, and rather than leave some blank space and get fired, he thought he'd better invent a new kind of challenge to join the word searches and things that he had. So he came up with this strange diamond shape that he called a word cross, and a set of what he called definitions of words to put in there. And little did he know that we would still be talking about what he did 100 years later.
Well, and it took a while to catch on, didn't it?
It did. It was his puzzle had its fans in the New York World, but it really took until America of the 20s embraced every fad going for the crossword to really explode. So in 1925, Mr. Simon and Mr. Schuster of Simon and Schuster decided that they needed some books to publish. They had a publishing company, but no actual books. They put out a collection of crossword puzzles. It had changed its name from Word Cross to Crossword by then, and they were lucky to be coming just as the Mahjong craze was dying out, and America needed something else to roar about in the 20s. The crossword appeared and went absolutely stellar in the year of 1925, to the extent that, you know, perfectly sensible women could turn up to boutiques and ask to be decked out in robes that would make them look like a crossword puzzle, or buy little earrings with black and white checkered squares on them.
Well, and as I understand it, the crossword puzzle was more popular in the United States rather than Britain. Why was there such a difference in the appeal?
I think Americans are more up for fun, is one explanation. The other thing is that when the kind of the British establishment saw that the crossword was so big in America, they were a bit suspicious, as British people sometimes are, of Americans who are enjoying themselves. And the newspapers in particular in Britain were very hostile to the crossword. My theory is that they didn't like the fact that they didn't like the idea of people spending money on books of puzzles rather than on newspapers. And so the newspapers of the United Kingdom ran essentially a campaign against crosswords, saying we can't let these things come over here because working men are doing these silly puzzles when they should be, you know, they should be benefiting their employers, and mothers are letting their children go hungry because they've become addicted to these crazy puzzles. But, you know, as with any of these things that become popular, the newspapers will happily kind of hypocritically do a complete U-turn and say, well, maybe these things aren't so bad after all. I mean, even the New York Times was initially very skeptical about crosswords and considered them very lowbrow. And then they figured, well, people do kind of like them. Maybe we should have one.
Well, that's ironic, too. I mean, the New York Times Sunday puzzle is probably one of the most popular, at least here in the United States.
Yeah, the de facto puzzle, I think, is the New York Times Sunday one.
Yeah.
I suppose what they did was they made it a little better. You know, this first puzzle that was created in 1913 was not a very good one. The clues weren't very good. The same answer was in there twice. It was quite confusing to find your way around. You didn't really know where to write the answers in. But the New York Times, they actually recruited the woman that used to be the fact checker on the New York World. And she'd spent Margaret Petherbridge, her name was, she became Margaret Farrar. She'd spent a long time kind of looking with a very close eye at how the crossword works and established a lot of rules about word length and symmetry in the grid and fairness to the solver. And she made it a much more satisfying and edifying thing to do. And the sort of conventions that she established, I suppose, in the 20s and 30s are ones that are still followed by crossword constructors to this day.
Yeah, let's talk about those just a little bit. If you could take us behind the scenes of what goes into creating these puzzles. They're not just, I mean, you look at a blank one on the page and it's almost a work of art, all these little designs and the grid and the symmetry on them. But it's actually a systematic thing, an official way to build the puzzle. Why don't you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so what Margaret Petherbridge realized was that if you have, for example, if you have a grid where various sections of that shape are isolated from each other, that's nice for the constructor because they can kind of put in whatever words they like, but it's less satisfying for the solver because it's harder to get that one answer that helps you get another answer. So there are sort of, I suppose there are almost architectural considerations like that she came up with, which I didn't really ever appreciate until I started trying to construct puzzles myself. And what I realized was it's very easy to start a puzzle that you think is amazing, and what you realize is every word you put in limits the words that can cross with it, and you end up with a corner where you have to use kind of the name of some town in Alaska that no one's heard of, or a piece of slang that hasn't been used for 50 years. And of course, a puzzle like that would never appear in the paper. So that experience made me realize the kind of the formal constraints that people have. But what Margaret Petherbridge was also concerned about, I suppose, was the tone, was the language, and the sort of the world of words that you're asking the solver to enter into. So if your listeners will forgive me for saying the word urine is a word that crossword constructors would love to be able to use, because there aren't that many five-letter words that begin with U and it has these lovely vowels that it would mean that it would fit into a grid very readily. But Margaret Petherbridge's advice to constructors, and which is followed to the Times to this day, is do people really want to be writing that word into their puzzle? The first thing in the morning is the first thing they do in their day with their coffee. Probably not.
Yeah, well, and that's it makes you wonder how often five-letter words starting with U come up in the crossword puzzle. And as I understand it, she also established a rule of no two-letter words.
Yeah, and what I think has helped out with is it means that we don't always see the same two-letter words, because if you were to allow these two-letter words in a grid, you would probably just keep getting the same ones coming up again and again. Do, for example, and sure, there are a bunch of ways you could clue that as the verb to do, or you could use the musical note in do re mi, but solvers would kind of they get bored if they see the same words coming up time and time again. So it's another way in which the more life becomes difficult for the constructor, the more satisfying it is for the solver.
And there are a number of tricks that puzzle constructors like to play on us innocent victims here to make it extra tricky and kind of a brain teaser. Can you tell us a little bit, for example, what a Nina is?
Well, I love Ninas when I spot them. And that's the thing, you don't always spot them. Mina is a slang term used by some of the creators of puzzles to refer to a message or a kind of theme in a grid that isn't announced. So sometimes you can solve a puzzle and get to the end and think you've done everything that there is to do, and then notice, oh, there's actually, all these words have something in common, or there's an extra message going up the diagonal of the grid. And I suppose the sort of geniuses with the warped minds who are very good at coming up with these puzzles, they relish a challenge. And so sometimes they add these challenges onto themselves, even if it's just to just sneak a message saying happy birthday, to their kid or something that's there in the diagonal that most solvers won't notice. But they're always lovely if you spot them. They're like a little extra treat, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Alan Connor. He's the author of The Crossword Century, 100 Years of Witty Wordplay, Ingenious Puzzles, and Linguistic Mischief. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Alan Connor about the rich history and wide appeal of the crossword puzzle.
And we invite you to join the conversation. What do you love about crosswords? What leaves you pulling your hair out on a Sunday morning? Let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Alan, just before the break, we were talking about some of the tricks that puzzle creators play. Tell us a little bit, though, about just the inherent challenge of playing a game with the English language. I mean, the language itself can be tricky.
It can. I think the English language, I think, is one of the hardest ones for non-native speakers to learn, because we have so many words for one given thing, because English has kind of sucked up bits of Greek and bits of Latin, and there are all these different words sort of competing with each other to describe one thing. And the other effect of that sort of hodgepodge of the English language is that one word can mean lots of different things. So what makes that thing that makes it very difficult to learn means that English is, I think, very good for wordplay and for kind of jokes and for being silly with language. So the kind of clues that I really like in American puzzles are those ones that that end with a question mark. And there's a couple I'm really fond of that have to do with traffic. So there's one I read, fits on a hard drive. And the answer to that is road rage. What I like about that is you've thought of fits as a verb, and it's a mm-hmm. noun, and you've thought of a hard drive as being something to do with computers, and in fact it's a difficult period of driving a car. Another one like that I've enjoyed is dangers for the over 70 crowd, and you think of seniors falling over or whatever, but the answer there is radar traps. And so I suppose what crossword constructors do is they look at that ambiguity that's there in the English language, and they use it to make you smile. What they want to do, I suppose, is that they want to confuse you, but they want you to then finally get it once you've got some of the letters and you see what the answer is. And for me, when the penny drops and you see how a clue like that works, it's like being told a joke. Your brain sort of hops from one place to another, and you get a little lift and a little smile, and the kind of pleasure that you don't really get from a Sudoku.
Yeah, I think that's why I struggle. I'm so literal that when I see a clue like that, I never think of the other punchline.
That's what they're doing. Yeah,
I get more of a kick of reading the answer key the next day, when it comes in the newspaper. Let's take a call from Sarah in Wausau. She's on the line. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. I never really was a fan of crossword puzzles, simply because I just didn't give myself the time to do it. But I value them as a teacher, and I'm teaching elementary grades. And let's say I'm teaching a unit on erosion or rocks. As a review, I can go on the computer and go on to programs like PuzzleMaker.com, I think it is. I'm at my computer right now. But there are all these free websites out there that can make crossword puzzles. And you can just type in the words that you want in there, and you can throw some extra words too, for fun. And within seconds, you'll have a crossword puzzle that you can use and get kids used to doing that kind of thing. So So it's a fun tool to use, and I really enjoy them. They're simple, but they're effective.
Thanks, Sarah. That's great. So using crossword puzzles as a learning tool, but also has a side effect of introducing young people to crosswords pretty early. What do you think about that, Alan?
I can kind of picture those kids having that that pleasure that you get of you look at a clue and you don't know what the answer is, but then you start with some of the easier ones. Those letters are there, and there's something very satisfying about filling up that grid. I think that's why some people prefer a pencil, because it feels like a real achievement sometimes to fill each of those squares with a letter and kind of build it all together like that. But I can also sympathize with the thing about having to devote the time to a puzzle, because they do take a while. You do sort of have to kind of put other things to one side. But what I sometimes find is that if there's something that's troubling me, I can go off and do a crossword puzzle, and it's almost like rebooting my brain. You know, I go off and do something completely abstract, and when I kind of come back up for air and go back out into the real world, the problems that have been troubling me sometimes seem easier to do.
And I know you delved into this just a little bit in your book, but crossword puzzles and activities like that are credited for things like staving off dementia. And your point there just reminded me of that. But did you find any truth to that belief?
Sadly, I didn't. You know, I was hoping it might be true, because sometimes people say, you know, why do you do this? Why are you hooked on these silly puzzles? Isn't it a waste of time? And it would be nice to say, oh, well, you know, I'm kind of insulating my brain against Alzheimer's. You know, like a lot of these medical stories that you read in the newspapers, there doesn't seem to be any actual research that backs that up. But what the psychological researchers do think is that if you have an activity that you do regularly, and if you do it socially, if you're calling out the clues to other people, and you're kind of putting your brains together and making your brain work in a way that it wouldn't normally work, then that does keep you ticking over. So that's my advice, is A, keep doing them, because you know, that social activity is important, but B, you know, if you're enjoying doing it, that's reason enough in itself. You know, the fun is the reason.
Speaking of advice, I was hoping you could take us through some tips you have for actually doing well with crossword puzzles and even getting faster at them. Because, I mean, there are people out there who take crossword puzzles so seriously, competing in national competitions. And there was a 2006 documentary about that called Wordplay. But you have a rudimentary toolkit for solving crossword puzzles. What's in it? Tell us about the toolkit.
Well, it was derived from some of the advice of the sort of people you see in that amazing documentary, Wordplay. So for them, because speed is everything, a lot of what they advise is purely down to literally just shaving seconds off your solve. So these kind of pro solvers will write a lowercase a rather than an uppercase one, because it shaves some fractions off their time. But one thing I found especially interesting about that documentary is, it's not something I've tried yet myself, is that the competitors have all got headphones on as they're filling in their puzzles in this crossword tournament. And what's playing in their headphones is, it sounds like white noise. It's actually the amplified sound of one of the lobbies at the United Nations building. So this kind of blocks out the outside world to them and lets them enter the zone of the puzzle. My other tip is sometimes start from the end, because there's a theory that the constructors may have written the clues in order, you know, from mm-hmm. one across onwards. And so the ones that they'll have written last, they might have been a bit more tired and a bit less fiendish. And so you may have better success from starting in the southeast corner, as it were, and building it up from there.
Oh, I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, and by the time they get there, their options are fewer in terms of constructing clever words. So you might get some easy clues there. And you also said to have someone tell a joke before solving the puzzle. What's that going to do for us?
That was one of the odd things that I found when I was looking into the dementia kind of theory. Was you get these strange pieces of research that people have sometimes done. And one thing that that came out of some academic research into humor and the way that the brain works is that people who have been told a joke 10 minutes beforehand perform better at crossword puzzles and are better at are faster at solving them and get more of the clues. And that seemed odd to me, which is why I made a note of it. But then the more I thought about it, the more I thought about this way in which, well, you know, jokes aren't that much unlike crossword puzzle clues sometimes. They ask your brain to go in one direction, and then suddenly there's this left turn there, and the whole thing adds up. But it's that element of surprise that you get in a joke and with a really good crossword clue, I think is why a joke is a kind of limbering up exercise for doing a crossword puzzle. Mm.
Well, if we want to study up and get better at solving these crossword puzzles, maybe have some more knowledge about the obscure facts that might be asked of us as we're filling them out, are there certain subject areas we should try to study up on, or should we study up on a little bit of everything? What's your approach to gaining that knowledge?
I think I would say read the newspaper. And the reason for that is that what the constructors of these puzzles have to do is they have to avoid being too clever themselves, because if they ask for something that that you only know about if you've got a kind of master's degree in astrophysics, well, the solvers are going to be understandably angry. They're going to write to the newspaper, and you're going to find that you're not getting commissioned to do any more puzzles. So what the constructors have to do, which is a very difficult thing to do, I think, is to have a sense of, you know, what does everybody know? You know, what will they have picked up on? Which bands are high frequency enough pop bands that I can fairly ask about them, and which of them are kind of fly by night people who might be forgotten even by the time this puzzle goes into print? And I think you know, the newspaper is a natural home for the puzzle in that way, because if you're familiar with the kind of the geographical references in the newspaper and the historical figures and the new words that are coming in, like twerk or whatever, that weren't in the English language a year before, then you've probably got that toolkit that's necessary for the puzzle.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thank you. I've had a wonderful time.
That was Alan Connor, quizmaster and author of The Crossword Century, 100 Years of Witty Wordplay, Ingenious Puzzles, and Linguistic Mischief.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. The news is next here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.